Hey everybody, welcome to episode 121 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back, welcome aboard. Before we get to today's episode, I just have a couple of announcements to make. The first is that we are probably about two-thirds of the way through this season. This is currently the 16th episode of season 6, and I'm hoping to release 22 or 24 episodes for this season. So you should expect several more episodes to carry you into September or October. And the big announcement, the thing I do not believe I have mentioned on this show yet, is that Erica and I are moving to Spain in the beginning of August. I don't know for sure what the overall impact is going to be on this podcast, but that does mean we will be moving across the globe during the last few episodes of this season. I don't yet know how that move is going to ultimately impact this show, but I will hopefully have updated information about what you can all expect for a season 7 or future seasons of this show later in the year once we have settled in Spain. And with that out of the way, let's get to today's episode. Today we have a wonderful conversation with a really lovely person. This was recorded in Carnation, Washington, outside of Seattle, during a road trip I did earlier in this year. Today we are speaking with Morgan McShay, and one of the things that really excites me about this episode is all of the new topics that we discuss that have not ever been discussed on this show thus far. So prepare yourself for an episode all about forest bathing, tiny home dwelling, roller derby, and the overall impact that the outdoors and nature can have on a person's life. So get ready. This is a fantastic episode. Let's head over to Carnation, Washington, and talk to Morgan McShay.
My name is Morgan McShay. I am a student in a sustainability program. I live in a tiny house in the forest. I'm working on a capstone on forest bathing. I'm 32 years old, so I'm kind of on a brand new journey discovering my career and purpose. I previously worked in the fashion industry and the film industry and lived in Los Angeles for over a decade and did a lot of work that was sometimes fun and creative and sometimes soul-crushing. And then I moved to Washington and fell in love with nature and decided to pivot and change my entire life.
This is going to be interesting because there's going to be some overlap in our life stories, but locations are exactly the opposite. So I went to Los Angeles and discovered this love of nature, and you had to get the fuck out of Los Angeles to discover yours.
Absolutely.
And the way you and I met, we were trying to figure this out earlier. It's been 10, 12 years since we've seen each other.
Yes.
The way we met is very different than what we're doing right now, which is sitting on the porch of your tiny house in the primordial woods in Washington. So let's start somewhere way back in the beginning. How did you end up in L.A.? Why'd you end up in LA? And then why did you decide to leave?
I ask myself that all the time. I grew up in a place called Palmdale, California. It's not known for much of anything except for Afro Man.
I didn't know it was known for that.
That's what we got. Yep, that's Palmdale.
All I know Palmdale for is just being the desert north of the beautiful forest. Dead, desolate desert north of the beautiful forest.
Okay, yeah, I guess that too. But yeah, it's about 60 miles north of Los Angeles. You know, I grew up there. My family moved there when I was 6 from New York. When I was in high school, I was very interested in theater and costume and fashion, and I really liked to sew. when I was a junior in high school, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do for college, and someone from the Fashion Institute came to my school, and they were like, hey, you can apply early. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll apply early. And then I got accepted as a junior, and then my senior year, I was like, well, I already know where I'm going to college, and it's art school, so I'm just gonna take all art classes. So I like didn't take any additional math or science, and just really leaned into art and did like digital media and theater and studio art. Yeah, and then I went to the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising. I did their apparel manufacturing program because I wanted to have my own clothing company at the time. I thought it would be fun. Yeah, and then I graduated. I started interning at a company that does, you know, premium denim. So they produce domestically in Los Angeles, everything from, you know, cutting, sewing, washing, dyeing, processing, all that. And I found it really fun and like exciting. It was fast paced. And then I just kind of kept doing that for a while until I felt a bit creatively burnt out there, because consumerism and a lot of just making shit to make. Yeah, it was just making a lot of stuff that felt unnecessary. All of the design was really dictated by sales. So the sales rep would come into the office and be like, we need you to make camo skinnies. And I'd be like, I don't want to make camo skinnies, and I don't think people should wear camo skinnies.
How old are you at this time? Because I feel like you were still pretty young when I met you, and you were art department at that point.
Yeah.
So right now you're a fashion person.
Mm-hmm.
So are you, this is like late teens?
Yeah. So I graduated that program when I was 19, and then I started working right away. So yeah, I was probably like 20, 21 doing this stuff. And I actually left the fashion industry when I was 23 to go work in film. It was on a total whim. I had some friends that were studying film at LMU, and I would kind of help them on weekends just doing their student projects. First doing costume, and then another friend of mine had me do set design, and I was like, wait, set design is a job? That's a thing? And they're like, yeah, we have like people are studying that at our school. You can do that as a career. And I was like, no way. I talked to someone I knew in the fashion industry who had a friend in the film industry, and they're like, hey, yeah, they're doing a feature film right now. Like, you could probably go be an art PA. So I did that on a weekend, and it was so fun and so weird. And I quit my job like 2 weeks later to go just do it. And then I ended up in film, and that's, yeah, where we met.
Yeah, interesting. So, yeah, I assumed that you had began in the art department. I didn't realize you were in fashion, accidentally rolled in to set design, and then we met on that Goofy Walgreens project, right?
Yeah. Were you on Topsy McGee?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
I
was on post for that.
Okay. I'm trying to remember the first time. I don't even remember how I met Travis.
It would have been on that, if not before.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember if there was something before Topsy McGee. The one where they were action figures.
Oh, Shelf Life.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, so I worked on the Shelf Life stuff too. We're talking about stuff that no one in the audience is familiar with. But these were all different projects. Shelf Life was like a live action Toy Story for adults. Topsy McGee was a steampunk airship short. And then the Walgreens project was this thing we did for Walgreens that was a shit ton of annoying work and
never
was
to
thrown
be
in the
seen.
Garbage so no one could ever see it because the product it was for was canceled.
Yep. Yeah. By the time I met you, I had been an art PA I got into this art crew and did a couple of like features and like very, very low budget, like spec commercials and horror films and things with them. And so I was doing that primarily. And then when I met you all, that was more like legitimate work.
Really? You were legitimate work?
Yes.
Because everything you named was like for the internet. I mean, I guess Walgreens was like a legitimate client with a legitimate budget. But yeah, both Shelf Life and Topsy McGee were friends of ours projects that went straight to YouTube.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it felt more legit maybe because you all seemed more to know what you were doing.
That makes me feel good because that was when we were all learning what to do.
Well, I was like 22, so.
I don't know. It just makes me wonder about the people you were working with before us, if we seemed like we knew what we were doing.
That's a whole nother podcast.
So you move from fashion because you get a bit disillusioned with that. You go into set design, which seems very fun and exciting and creatively rewarding. But at some point, that's going to change. And you're going to decide you've had enough of Los Angeles, which you said you lived there for 10 years. You moved to Palmdale at 6, and then you moved to Los Angeles...
17.
17. Okay. So you're gonna be in LA basically as an adult. Then you moved there as an adult. You're not counting Palmdale as an extension of Los Angeles.
No. I don't count Palmdale as anything.
Sorry, Afro man. All right. So tell us about how... this job that seemed really creative and fun lost your interest and made you flee to the opposite side of the country.
Yeah, gosh. It was a lot. I mean, there were things about it that I legitimately still miss today. I do miss getting to work with entirely different groups of people on different projects because sometimes you have a really great group of people and they're really fun and you end up becoming friends. I loved that kind of novelty. I really loved projects where I had some sense of creative agency, as in like I got the script and I got to read it and interpret it and offer ideas for the way I thought something would look, the type of prop or what have you, the way the set looked. I loved doing production design. That was the kind of work that I got to do with you all, where I was kind of in a position where I had some creative autonomy. But the unfortunate thing is those projects where I was in a position of authority tended to not be either well-paid or consistent. So I ended up, and I feel really lucky that I was able to do this, but I joined the union, but not as a production designer, as a set dresser, Local 44. And that essentially put me on union work, which was well-paid, but I didn't get to be creative. I was the person who was on the set where it was like, hey, we need to put the camera where this coffee table is. Move the coffee table. And it's like, sure, I'll move the coffee table for like $30 an hour. It's the most money I've ever made in my life. But at a certain point, it was kind of like, this isn't very fun either.
The union can be kind of a double-edged sword, right? Because it's there to take care of you. It's there to help you get these guaranteed jobs where you get paid well. But it also can just force you into a cubby where all of your work then must be that very specific work. And I imagine it can be hard to expand outside of that once you're in there.
Yes. And the other thing too that I don't know gets talked about a lot, but I really struggled with, is when you're in the union, you have to maintain a certain number of hours to maintain your health insurance and things like that. So I found myself trying to schedule myself in a way that I had enough union jobs that I would still have health insurance and could pay rent, and then trying to balance that with like actual creative fulfilling projects. And it just got really exhausting. And I also found that I'm the type that like, and I still have this problem, I would say yes to everything and spread myself super thin. And then I would end up on like some feature film that's like all night shoots for 3 weeks and then get like super sick or super just burnt out, or not have a life outside of film. Like it was really hard to maintain a relationship or like have like friends that I see consistently. I was doing roller derby at the time and it was like, I can't make any practice when I'm on a feature or when I'm traveling. Or it became really exhausting in that way. And also the imposter syndrome is something that I did not cope well with. Again, I feel really lucky that I was like in the union when I was 23 years old. But at the same time, the art department was still quite male dominated. And especially in the union, there were a lot of things where it was like me and a crew of like five dudes that were like, I don't know, 25 years old, that were just like talking about like their Tinder dates and had like a scoreboard that was like in the art truck. And I'm just there like, why am I here? This isn't what I want. I feel like I've gone in a lot of cycles where I've had like a reckoning of like, this isn't what I want. And then I tend to react rather dramatically. Like I quit my fashion job after like having one film job. And then after a moment of just clarity in film, I packed up and moved out of the state.
Are you saying that you are impetuous?
Yes.
So that's really what happened. You said, I'm sick of this. This isn't what I want anymore. I'm just going to leave the state.
Yeah, more or less. Yes.
So how did you choose? Did you go directly to Washington?
I was between, and it was me and my partner at the time. We met in the film industry and we both kind of stopped working in film at the same time. We realized we don't need to be in Los Angeles. Like, we're not in film anymore.
And honestly, even if you are these days, you don't need to be in Los Angeles. To get good work, you might not even want to be in LA anymore.
Right. We didn't want to be in LA anymore. And it was kind of like, well, where do you want to go? And we were between Seattle and Portland, knowing nothing about either, having never been to either.
Oh, interesting. I assumed that you had some sort of connection to the Northwest, but you did not.
No. Impetuous, okay. Remember?
Right. Was it just like, it seems really cool and green and pretty up there. We should go up there.
Yeah. It was kind of like, I heard there's this place that exists that has seasons and trees and water and mountains. And apparently people there are happy. What do you think?
So it was everything that was the opposite of Palmdale is what you're saying? You were looking for the polar opposite of Palmdale.
Yes. Yep, exactly. And like, in LA too, I mean, we were in an expensive apartment in like a rather like kind of dirty, poor air quality spot. And it was just kind of like, why do we pay so much to live here? Like, I don't know. It was just a lot of things where it was like, I don't know. We can go anywhere, I guess, or we could try.
I bet if I told you how much it costs to live there now, your head would explode.
I'm sure it would. I mean, I think about it all the time. I was making really, really good money in film, but I was spending so much to live somewhere that I hated, and it stopped making sense at a point.
So you pack up your car, and then you just drive and decide you'll figure it out, or had you chosen a spot and drove towards that spot?
So we talked about moving away from California in, I want to say, like March of 2016. And then I think by May of 2016, it was like, let's take a trip to Seattle. And then we went and we're like, this is beautiful. Let's do it. And then I think I quit my job a month later and then we moved.
The thing I think is funny about choosing Seattle is one of the few places, and granted I haven't spent that much time in Seattle, but it's one of the few places where I actually miss LA traffic, because Seattle traffic can be even worse.
You know, I think a lot of people in Seattle would feel like validated to hear that. I disagree. People complain about it all the time here and I'm like, you have no idea.
All right. So you chose Seattle. Seattle mm-hmm. seemed great. You drove up to Seattle.
Yeah.
And then what happened from there? Because you've got to find a new career path. You've got to find a new place to live. And then you've got to establish yourself here and figure out what the hell your life is going to look like.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like it took a really long time to get to the point where I'm at right now. A lot of things happened. Another reason for choosing Seattle was kind of like, if I go back to fashion, which is literally my only education that I have to go back on, there is somewhat of an industry in Seattle, at least more so than Portland. So that was kind of my initial fallback. I wasn't in love with the idea, but I think there was still a part of me that's like, maybe there is a job that I can find in fashion that doesn't feel like I'm having my soul sucked out, and it can be somewhere like pretty. So that was kind of the ideal.
Or if you're going to have your soul sucked out, at least you want a nice view.
Yeah, exactly. Literally, yes, exactly. So that was kind of my like first thought for what to do, but I literally had no idea. I had a pretty good savings from all the film work that I had done, so I had a bit of a cushion coming here. My partner at the time did remote work, so it didn't matter where he was. And we ended up in this great little spot in Greenwood, which is, you know, like a cute part of Seattle. I kind of just tried to figure it out. I briefly started my own company, like on Etsy, quickly found out that is not what I want to do. I was doing like screen printing in my apartment with like cats and ink and trying to like dry it with industrial equipment, like, and hope that I don't get in trouble with the landlord.
I know. And hoping you don't poison yourself.
Oh yeah, that too. Yeah. Yeah. Also that. So I did that for a little bit and I was like, oh, that's not right. I worked at a few different random companies in Seattle doing fashion, and it was the same thing where I was just like, I don't think I like this. And I kind of started to freak out because I was like, well, it's my entire education. I have no other skills, really. I mean, I was too freshly burnt out from film to think, like, I'll just do film in Seattle. Like, that wasn't an option. Because I felt like film kind of brought me to the point of, like, an emotional breakdown when I had left. So I was like, I'm not going back to that. So what I ended up doing is I enrolled in AmeriCorps, which is maybe, like, a sign of not the most sound financial decision-making.
So explain what AmeriCorps is. I mean, is that like Peace Corps kind of thing?
Not quite. I mean, it's...
I know I've heard of AmeriCorps, but I'm not really clear on what it is or does.
It's like a governmental program. It's really designed for, like, students or probably very, very old people who are looking to do work mostly in the environmental sector, but in other places as well, a lot of nonprofits and things. But basically, the government pays you very, very little money, and then they give you an education stipend at the end. So you enroll. It's usually like a 9-month period or maybe more, depending. I don't know now. This was back in 2018 that I did it. But you go and you put in an application, and then you get partnered with an organization that liked your resume and application, and then you work for them for a term, and then you get an education stipend. So I did that. I knew that I enjoyed the environment as soon as I moved here, and I was like, wow, like, nature's really cool. I had no idea.
Yeah, because you grew up in Palmdale, where nature was sand and dirt and intense heat.
Yeah, dangerous. It was actually, like, quite inhospitable in Palmdale. It was very, very hot in the summer, very, very cold in the winters.
But you had Charlie Brown Farms not far away, where you
wow.
could get some dinosaur sculptures and some local honey.
Yeah, I think you've managed to say our only attraction that we have. So as soon as I came here and I saw, like, the sound and just everything, started hiking, which was a thing that I hadn't done before, I was like, okay, I think I want to do work with the environment, but I have zero education. So AmeriCorps just seemed like the best route. And I got partnered with Puget Soundkeeper Alliance, which is a nonprofit that works on protecting and preserving the waterways of Puget Sound. So they do a lot of stewardship and environmental education, pollution monitoring. They do a lot of beach cleanups. So it was kind of the coolest thing ever because I got to go do kayak cleanups on Lake Union one day a week for like 9 months straight.
And true to the American way, when you were feeling like you were losing your soul making unnecessary clothing products that no one actually needed, you get paid better. But when you're doing something that actually impacts the environment and then the lives of everyone and has meaning, you won't get paid well.
Yes. And, you know, it's actually, in a way, I felt as I was doing this that I was kind of doing penance for, like, my fashion work.
For all the trash that you yeah. added to the environment.
Literally, like, pulling plastic garbage out of the lake for, like, $6 an hour. And I'm like, yeah, this is, you deserve this.
You were like, holy shit, I designed this skirt.
Oh, no. So after I did that, I knew for sure, I was like, okay, I definitely want to work in the environment. So the next step that made sense was school, because I just didn't have the education and there was no other way. So then I decided, it's like 28 years old, I was like, well, I guess I'm going back to college. And I am near the end of that journey now. I graduate in June.
Oh, nice. And what is the program that you're in right now?
So I first started at Shoreline Community College and did my AA in environmental studies. I had thought about doing environmental science, but for reasons described earlier, I don't have a lot of scientific education background, particularly in high school. I also went to Catholic school, and I think that really altered a lot of scientific knowledge that most normal people have by this age. So I decided to go with environmental studies, which I found actually to be more suited to me anyways. It's a lot of social science and understanding people, and that lended really well to the sustainability program that I transferred into as a bachelor's and what I'm doing now.
So what's that look like? What are you studying about sustainability, and how does that turn into a career path?
Gosh, yeah. Sustainability is, I feel like it's the answer to all of our problems, or at least that's the thing that keeps me, like, doing what I'm doing now. Sustainability kind of rests on the notion that there is a future that exists where people can be healthy and happy, the environment can be clean and regenerated, and there can still be economic prosperity. And the idea is just that sustainability can be applied to kind of any industry or sector or company or what have you. And if it's applied from that perspective, we can actually build a future where, like, it's not just people struggling to survive under capitalism and then ultra, ultra wealthy people taking advantage of them while the environment burns, essentially.
I think many, many people listening on this show will agree that that is a worthwhile path. So what does that path look like for you? So you're studying these aspects of how we can build that reality. So once you graduate, what kind of jobs would be available in this field? I know a lot of businesses are now jumping on this bandwagon, so it seems like a promising decision.
Yes. The most logical path, which I will not be taking, would be to go back to the fashion industry and do it with a sustainability lens. Because, you know, fast fashion and all of that is causing so many environmental problems. So that is one pathway that's viable for me, to go work for companies and help them to be better or do less harm. The path that I'm more interested in is likely policy advocacy work. And I think environmental policy is really important. We talk a lot in sustainability about top-down versus bottom-up actions, or the idea of collective action versus individual action. And I think with sustainability there and climate change, a lot of individuals feel powerless. You know, what does it matter if I drive an electric car when, you know, this celebrity has a private jet that they take everywhere? And that's a valid argument. I'm not going to say they're wrong, but at the same time, I believe that we need both. You need to do both things. You need to think about your individual choices, because collectively they add up. But I also think that policy needs to inform actions. And I like the idea of going the policy route, because I can affect change that hopefully spreads down to individuals, or at least starts the conversation of, like, why is this a law? Why is this a policy? Why is this being proposed? I think having those kind of conversations can help spur change. So that's kind of one route that I am exploring. But the other one that I'm maybe more excited about, but again is probably less of a financial payoff, is forest bathing and nature therapy. My capstone project is all about forest bathing, which is the idea, it comes from a Japanese practice called Shinrin-yoku. And the idea is that you immerse yourself in nature. You get out of your analytical brain and you start to just be in nature and immerse yourself with all your senses. So forest bathing sessions kind of look like taking a group out to a forest or any green space and just inviting people to experience nature with their senses. I personally stumbled upon this, like, when I had a lot of stuff going on in my life and, like, emotionally and personally. And I found that my connection with nature was kind of the thing that made me hopeful for the future and for my purpose and for, like, the value that I as an individual inherently have. I like the idea of pursuing forest bathing, at least as a career, even if it's only for, like, you know, volunteer nonprofits where I don't get paid to do it, but I still do it because I want to. Because I think that this connection with nature is a lot of, I think it's the root cause for a lot of our societal ills. We've, as a society, have really lost touch with our sense of belonging and our sense of place, our sense of value. I think we live really individualized lives, separate from other people and connection, separate from nature. We spend so much time indoors and staring at screens, and just, I think we've just really lost touch with why we're here. And I see forest bathing as kind of a way to repair that connection that people have both with nature and with themselves. And my hope is that in restoring that connection, maybe that'll kind of change a lot of the priorities that people have that kind of drive behavior that is detrimental to the environment and to people generally.
You're touching on kind of one of the core tenets of this show, because this show kind of originally started as a, hey, I want to help other people know about all these different outdoor things that they could be doing with their life that maybe they aren't really aware of, or they think they don't have access to. But it's also evolved beyond just the enjoyment a person gets from doing outdoor activities or getting out in nature. Exactly what you're talking about is one of the things that I think is most valuable, which is, as a society, we kind of pulled ourselves away from nature. In some ways, we've taught ourselves to fear it. We have a really inaccurate idea of our place in it. And I feel like we need to bring everyone back to it so that they can learn their place in it, stop fearing it, learn to embrace it, realize it's not infinite, realize that its health is also your health, and that also it can enrich your life a lot more than TikTok.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
So we're coming to it from different places, but as much as my show might seem like it's just this trivial thing where it's like, oh, why would I go mountain biking or scuba diving or whatever? It's all kind of linked back to that place, which is if we bring people outside and we get them to care about it, they will naturally want to take care of it.
Yes.
And they will share it with other people, and we can live in a world where we're not afraid of nature anymore, and we realize we're part of nature, and we can work as a unit.
Yes. I think something that I found really fascinating that we learned about in one of my classes was the idea of ecological identity. It's something that a lot of kids naturally build playing outside, or like exploring the woods, or just things that you do, climbing trees, you know, digging your hands in the dirt, or, you know, walking around barefoot. I feel like that's a thing that's very normal for people to develop. And it's not something that I really had growing up in the desert, and certainly not as I became an older adult in Los Angeles. And I feel like I was able to discover this ecological identity as an adult. And now I have this bond with nature, and this sense of like comfort and solace in it that I didn't know was possible. So the way I approach forest bathing and the work that I'm trying to do is, I guess, from an empathetic lens of knowing what it's like to not have that, and knowing what it's like to have it now and how valuable it is. And I'm just trying to help people find that, because I think my road here has been quite rocky, because I mentioned, you know, a long-term relationship moving to Washington. That relationship ended in a really messy way that was my doing, and like it was prompted also by like the sudden death of my dad, which like threw me for a loop, and just like all of these things that really rocked me to my core. When that relationship ended, I was by myself. I found myself like going out on hikes and going out for walks by myself, and the only time that I did not feel alone was when I was out in nature. It saved my life, and it also changed everything that I value and want to do. And I just think that it's a shame if people don't get a chance to at least experience that. That's what I want to do. Like, that's the work I want to do. I just want to help people find what I've found, even a fraction of it.
Yeah, I can totally identify with that. Forest bathing, I want to talk about that a little bit more. I think you did a great job explaining what it is, and it's a thing I think people are starting to hear about, and some people maybe are familiar with it, but a lot of people probably still aren't. What does a session forest bathing look like? Are we talking about an hour, 2 hours? Do you get a bunch of people together? Do you guide them? Do you just all go off separately? What does it look like when you go out to do that?
I should start this by saying I am not a certified forest therapist guide, because that is a thing and it is something I want to pursue. But I've been doing this capstone as a student, and I feel very fortunate to have had the partners that I've had. Typically, what the sessions look like, there are a few different things that I'm doing. For starters, I am partnering with the Outdoor Wellness Leaders, which is like a group on campus that does outdoor recreation. And I've partnered with this girl, Riley, who is their program manager. We have coordinated a series of events. The first and most simple are just drop-in forest bathes that we do on campus once a month. We're very fortunate on our campus. We have 60 acres of restored wetlands. We have a food forest. We have a campus farm. So we have ample green space. And the idea was just that gosh, students are so stressed out and depressed. You know, seasonal affective disorder is quite real here. So how can we help alleviate that? And the idea just came like, okay, we can do an hour long forest bathing session on like a Tuesday at 11 a.m. And that's what we do. And students come and I will take them out. And the process is pretty simple. Forest bathing, there are a bunch of different schools of thought on it, but the one that I lean on is from Amos Clifford. He has, you know, different books and things about forest bathing, but he has a series of different invitations, and they're called invitations because you, as a participant, can choose to take the invitation or not. But essentially, I will say to the group, okay, I invite you to think about this or focus on this. For example, there's one invitation that's called fox walking. And the idea is just that you walk with all of your senses amplified. So if anything catches your attention, a flutter of motion, a sound in the distance, a bird call, a smell, anything, you stop and you give your full attention to it, whatever it is. It doesn't matter, big or small. You do that for a section of the walk. Forest baths aren't hikes. There's not like a destination that you're going to. You're just out in nature. So this invitation could last 10 minutes. It could be an hour if you wanted to. It's kind of just open to the space that you're in and how participants are reacting to it. But typically we will do a series of like, I don't know, maybe two or three invitations in that hour. And then after each invitation, we have what's called like a council where we all circle up and just share what we noticed. By doing so, you can help someone to maybe notice something that they hadn't, or, you know, talking about it helps you realize something that you did notice, but you didn't realize you noticed. And it just, again, creates a community. I actually find the council to be one of the most important parts of forest bathing because it intentionally centers having conversations about things that you would normally consider trivial, where you just end up talking about like, yeah, I noticed the moss on this rock and I touched it and it felt like this. It's like, you don't really talk like that in normal society. You're too busy. You have too much stuff to do. Like, that's not important.
You do if you're 6 years old.
Exactly. That's the other thing too. One of the invitations that we did, you like lay on the ground and you look at the clouds and you just see what you see. And then afterwards you talk about it and you look at the clouds together. It's all about being a kid again. It really is. A lot of the tactile invitations are really just like, pick up some dirt, see how it feels on your hands. How does the water in the stream feel on your skin? Like, what do you smell right now? It's really just being aware and present. And yeah, doing things that you intuitively do as a child and that we've just lost touch with because it doesn't seem to be important anymore for some reason.
I also think there's a danger when we stop doing things that we did as children sometimes. I think part of it is, you know, just all the responsibility of adulthood. We very quickly kind of fall into this world where we think we understand everything and we think we've figured out how the world operates and what people are like. And then we just kind of shut ourselves down to new thoughts, new experiences. And that's a really dangerous place to let yourself go as an adult.
Yes. And that's another thing that's really interesting too about when we do counsel. There has to be an intentionality to get away from like being a naturalist. I think a lot of people that end up going on these forest bathes are into nature. So they want to talk about the black-capped chickadee that they're looking at. And it's less about like identifying species and being able to name things and categorize them. And it's really just about experiencing it and seeing how it makes you feel to experience it. One of the invitations that we talk about is called heart sense. And it's really what it sounds like, where you just check in with your body and see how it felt to look at, I don't know, a beautiful tree, or what it felt like when you stepped on a branch and it snapped. It's less about knowledge or proving that you can identify something and categorize it, and it's just about feeling.
So what has been the reactions of people who come along? What is the feedback that you get when people join these? Because this is a sort of situation where I could see people showing up and they have a preconceived notion of what they're about to do.
Yeah, I have a few stories I could share because I've only talked about the on-campus events, but I also do off-campus events at North Creek Forest, which is a nearby forest to my school campus. And then I also do a few larger events, one of which with the Outdoor Wellness Leaders, we did a snowshoeing and forest bathing event, which was really fun. Most people don't know what they're getting into and just say, that sounds interesting. I guess I'll see what it's like. The number of people that ask me if it involves actual
bathing.
Yes. Yeah. No, you don't need to bring your swim trunks.
Have you ever had a person say, I don't want to get naked in front of other people. I don't want to do this.
Not yet. But I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that someone would think that. No, the feedback has been really amazing. So because I'm doing it for my capstone project, I am taking surveys so that I can have quantitative and qualitative data to discuss. And also, I just want to add to the body of research about forest bathing. In the surveys, I ask a simple 3-question survey. How are you feeling today? How do you feel right now? What mood are you in? And it's a Likert scale. So it's, terrible to excellent, essentially, as a 1 to 5 choice. I ask them, how are you feeling today? How connected do you feel to the environment? And how connected do you feel to your body? And then I ask those same 3 questions after we finish the walk, along with a few short answer where they can give as much or as little information that they want. So far, and I've analyzed all my data thus far, 100% of participants have improvement on their mood and their connection to their body and the environment. It's all improved. I'm not saying everyone goes from terrible to excellent, but most people will go from good to great or not good to good. I think that's pretty astounding for just an hour of being outside. When I get to the short answer responses, I get really touched because I get people saying I feel calmer. I feel like my nervous system has quieted down. I felt like a kid again. I had one individual who had a really beautiful moment that was a little unexpected for me. I never want to set expectations when we go into it because they say the forest is the therapist, the guide is just the facilitator. So whatever you're meant to have, whatever experience you're meant to have, you will have that day, whether it's crying or laughing or just feeling calm. But there was a woman who I gave an invitation where you go and you make contact with a tree. So you could sit against it, you could put your hand on it, you could hug it if you want. But you do that for an extended period of time, maybe 10 minutes. And part of the invitation was acknowledging trees and root systems and interconnections and the idea that we're all connected. So part of the invitation is as you're with this tree, maybe send a message that you want to send to someone and trust that the root system will carry that message to whoever it's meant to go to. And when we came back to council, she started crying because she was talking about her son who's on a backpacking trip in New Zealand and she hasn't gotten to see him in a while. And it's hard to talk to him on the phone because he's backpacking. And so she sent him a message and it just brought her to tears. That's a beautiful thing that I didn't expect, but I'm so grateful for because it's not dissimilar from, again, the experiences that I had where it was gosh, I have this terrible pain for whatever external reason. I come out to the forest or to nature and it alleviates it in some capacity.
So I think most people who come out to do a forest bathing experience are probably pretty open to it, but it is the sort of thing where with complete ignorance of what it is, people could make really negative assumptions about it. Have you had anyone show up who's been in that sort of mind state of, let me go see what this dumb thing is, and then you have to deal with them bringing this negative attitude into the experience? Or have you been lucky so far and you haven't run into those sorts of people? Or has somebody like that shown up and then by the end they're like, oh, this is actually really cool. I guess I shouldn't have come in being such a jerk.
I haven't had that happen, knock on wood, at least to my knowledge. I mean, I can't say that someone hasn't gone in skeptical and then had a good survey response. Yeah, I haven't had to deal with that, fortunately. I have had people who I can tell it's very difficult for. So they're not skeptical per se. I don't think they're coming into it thinking this is dumb or this isn't gonna work for me. But I have found that there are certain invitations, particularly ones like Sit Spot, where you're just meant to sit and not think. And I have participants who will sit, gaze for a bit, get up, look around, see everyone else still sitting, sit back down, get back up, just kind of okay, I did the thing, I sat, When we get back to council afterwards, I try to encourage those folks to be proud of themselves for sitting the amount of time that they did. Because I think, again, going back to society, I think we are conditioned to be productive. We feel like it's not right to just like sit and be. And if you are stuck sitting somewhere or like on an airplane, you have to like take advantage of that time and you better be productive. You better read that thing or respond to that email or, you know, figure out whatever problem in your brain. It's just like we don't give ourselves a break. So I think that's the biggest opposition I've seen is just people having difficulty like granting themselves just an hour to be outside. And I try to, again, come at them very compassionately and just say like, hey, be proud of that like 2 minutes you were able to do that, because it clearly like you don't afford yourself that.
Those are the people who probably most need to go.
Yeah.
And we do also have a issue that seems to be possibly becoming worse in our society, which is just consistent distraction. The idea that a person would get bored and not know what to do with their time has kind of disappeared because everyone distracts themselves with a phone or a tablet or something that can make sure every waking moment of their life is consumed in some way. And so I imagine that is a thing that forest bathing could really benefit people for. But also, I've got to imagine you run into people who they find it very hard to not be distracted. For instance, are people allowed to have their phones with them? Or do the phones get left somewhere before you go out?
If I could have total authority, I would like take away people's phones. But I encourage people to just put them away. There have been a few people that are like, oh, can I take a picture? And I'm like, sure, if that's what you feel compelled to do, I'm not going to say don't take a picture. But by and large, I think most people are excited for the opportunity. Like when I ask people like, please, you know, put your phone on silent, I think people kind of get excited to set their phone to do not disturb. Like, oh, she said I have to, so.
Right, they have an excuse to
do it.
Yeah,
because I think it's something we all want, really. I think it's something we crave. Like the occasional time where your phone dies and you don't have your charger and you're just like, well, oh well, I guess. It's kind of liberating in a way. Maybe terrifying for a lot of people too. I haven't had much of an issue with that. There is the occasional person that wants to take a picture and I'm like, fine. If it makes you feel more connected to like be able to look at a picture afterwards, sure. And I mean, that might be fair too, because we have a lot of wonderful access to green space in Washington, but also a lot of people are still like, you know, stuck in apartments, or maybe they have mobility issues and it's hard to get outside, or other illnesses. So if taking a picture allows someone to also like be able to reflect back on that moment or the things that they noticed or enjoyed, I'm not at all going to stop or discourage that.
So if people are listening right now and they are skeptical and they're like, I don't know, that sounds interesting, I guess, but not for me. What would you say to those people? And we can probably assume that 80% of the people having the thought that it's not for them are male.
Yeah. I would wager that people that are skeptical, I mean, listeners to your show that go outside and do things outdoors, I have a feeling there are at least certain things that they're already doing that would be forest bathing. Anytime that you're sitting in nature and not looking at your phone and not like going through some internal dialogue, anytime that you're really just sitting present, even if it's only for a minute, that's forest bathing. Any moment that you are looking at wildlife or hearing the sounds of birds or the smells of flowers, that's forest bathing. I think there's a lot of misconceptions that it's like very hippy dippy and that it's, you know, it's just about like being overly emotional and oversharing and like forced vulnerability.
You're probably going to try to sell me a bunch of crystals at the end.
Yeah, exactly. And like I would just challenge people who have those ideas to just suspend judgment. If you get proven wrong, or get proven right, I guess that's the worst outcome. But if you get proven wrong, that kind of opens up so many doors. I had one person in particular who, like, it was a guy, he was younger, and he seemed like he didn't want to talk about his emotions. And I felt like when I gave the first invitation, I could sense that he was kind of like not into it. And I was like, that's okay. Like, I'm just gonna like see how he does. And once we got into council and people started talking about things, I think he realized that it wasn't as scary. It's like, we don't need to talk about your parents. We don't need to talk about like who broke your heart. but you can contribute to this conversation about like a cool rock that you saw. Maybe internally, you'll find that something that you experienced outdoors does remind you of an internal issue that you're working on, but you're in no way forced to talk about that. And I think that's kind of the whole idea is you get to be outside, you get to have a community, and you get to maybe realize where your mind is going. Like if it's really that hard for you to let go of your thoughts, maybe it's a good reflection point to see what you're fixating on and maybe see if being outside in nature helps alleviate that, like it did for me.
So now I'm going to shift us to what might seem like an odd direction to go. But I know earlier in this conversation, before you left Los Angeles, you said you were currently in roller derby. So I want to hear a bit about what brought you to roller derby and what you got from that. And if that is still a part of your life or if that was just a small window.
Yeah, gosh.
And you're the first person I think on this show ever to talk about roller derby. And forest bathing.
Okay.
So you're here for all sorts of firsts.
Yes. Okay, let's see. Roller derby. I tell people whenever I get asked, like, how did you end up there? How did you get into that? It all started when I was maybe like 12 years old and I had a Mighty Ducks phase. And I just desperately wanted to like be the girl on the roller hockey team that like plays with all the neighborhood kids. But that wasn't a reality in Palmdale. We don't have ice rinks and things like that. So really, it was just me rollerblading by myself as a kid. And then it was just a fun thing that I enjoyed doing. And then I didn't really think much about it until I was in Los Angeles. It was 2013. I heard an ad on the radio. I know this makes me sound quite old, I feel, but I heard an ad on the radio that was just like, do you want to play roller derby? Come to the open tryouts at the Dollhouse. And I was like, I think I could do that. I could probably do that. So I went on eBay and I bought a pair of roller skates that were not the right size, but I wore them anyways. And I went to tryouts and I got my ass kicked. I was like, this was a mistake. It's actually really funny because there's two types of roller derby. One is a banked track and the other is a flat track. So banked track kind of dips downwards. So when you get hit, you fall and you roll, essentially. The tryouts that I went to were on a banked track. So naturally, I got hit and I fell and I rolled. I was so like embarrassed about it because I'm a perfectionist. And so when that happened, I like cried a lot afterwards. But I ended up telling a friend about it and she's like, oh, actually I play roller derby at this other league, but it's flat track. You should try that. And I was like, okay, yeah. I mean, I've like definitely humiliated myself in the banked track area, but I'm willing to give it another shot on flat track. So I went with my friend to Angel City, which is the flat track league out in LA. And I just started doing that and fell madly in love with it. And I did that until I moved out of Los Angeles. And then as soon as we moved to Seattle, I was like, well, I don't really know anyone here, but I'll join the roller derby league. And that's like an instant 300 friends. And roller derby really became like, especially when I didn't like my job and I didn't know what I was doing and I was trying to figure things out, like roller derby became my life and like my personality. And I was so very dedicated to it. I played on two teams in LA, one of which was the charter like travel team, the Rat City All-Stars. I got to go play a tournament in Finland. Like I got to travel around. We were really good. And I just did that. I still do it, but it's taken a real backseat between COVID and me being in school full-time and working full-time. So I go on rare occasion, but my hope is when I graduate, I can like fully go back and commit because I miss it desperately.
So if anyone's listening and they think roller derby is just girls or women roller skating and beating each other up, explain to people exactly what roller derby is.
Oh my God. Okay. Roller derby it's a real sport. I feel like I should start with there. It's a real sport. It's not like the 1970s, like staged, like wrestling on skates that some people are familiar with. It is incredibly strategic, especially flat track. Bank track can be a little bit theatrical because you just go so very fast that when you get hit, you go flying and you go flying into the guardrails. Flat track, it's a lot more controlled and that makes it a lot harder in my opinion because it's not just about speed and getting lucky. You really, really have to be like a skilled roller skater to be able to do the things that you do to stay upright and to score points while you have like four other people trying to like hit you and stop you with their bodies. Do you want to know the rules? I feel like that'll take
Yeah. Give us like the most simple version of the, we don't need to know the exact rules. Just tell us, like, okay, for instance, I don't know shit about football, but I understand the football is we have to get this ball from this side of the field to the other side of the field, and we have a certain amount of times we get to try to do that, and other people try to stop us. So something as simple as that for roller derby.
Okay, for roller derby, I guess you would say the jammer is the ball, because there's not a ball in this.
And the jammer is a human.
The jammer is a human, yes, very much so. Each team during a jam will put out four blockers and one jammer, and then the opposing team will put out the same. The blockers all set up above the start line, and then the two jammers start behind the start line. And then when the whistle goes, everybody goes. And the most basic idea is that the jammers are trying to get through the opposing blockers who are setting up in walls and other formations to try to stop them. You can't punch, you can't elbow, you can't kick, but you can like body check someone or shoulder check someone. So the idea is the jammer is trying to pass these opposing blockers and the blockers are using their bodies to stop them. The jammer gets through the opposing blockers. They make a lap around the track, which it's like an oval track. It's not like a perfect oval, but that's fine. The jammer gets out of the blockers, they make a lap, and then when they come back around, they get a point for each opposing blocker that they pass. So ideally, you're trying to get as many laps as possible so you can get as many points as possible. It gets strategic because if you're the first jammer out, you're lead jammer and you have the ability to call off or end the jam. So you can get out, score your points, and then call it off before the other jammer has a chance to score points, for example. And that's the gist.
So you're either a blocker or a jammer. Do you keep alternating between these, or do certain people tend to always be jammers, always blockers?
For the most part, it's pretty set where if you're a jammer, you're a jammer.
Were you a jammer?
I was a jammer. But the other really funny and strange thing is there is one blocker on the team called a pivot, and they wear a stripe on their helmet, and the jammer wears a star. And their helmet covers are like these fabric covers that go over your helmet. So the jammer can take off their star and give it to the pivot, and the pivot can put it on and become the jammer.
Oh, they're like a double agent.
Yes, very cool. So I kind of transitioned.
Also, being a pivot could be even cooler than being a jammer.
Okay, that is my opinion now. I kind of transitioned from jamming to blocking and mostly pivoting for that reason. Also, you get injured way less, and there's way less pressure on you, in my opinion, when you're a blocker. But it's so fun, especially as a pivot, because you can still jam and score points, but it's a lot less pressure.
So what do you think you got from doing roller derby? What do you think it gave you? Because we know you've talked all about what forest bathing has given you and added to your life. What did roller derby give you?
Oh, gosh. A broken middle metacarpal and a knee surgery. But also, no,
In addition to these wonderful things.
I should say, like, I think that's another thing that keeps people from roller derby. I've been playing for over a decade, and those are, like, my two big injuries, which is really not that bad, all things considered. It's given me so much. Roller derby, again, it became kind of like my personality, something that I really cared deeply for at a time where I was really lost, honestly. Again, I didn't really know what I was doing in my career, in my relationship, where I was living, yada, yada. Derby was kind of it was a goal. It was fun. It was physical. And it was so communal. To have a space to go to 2 to 3 times a week where you see like your friends and you get to have success together, or you get to fail together. Like, I don't know. I think there's a lot of things that sports add to your life, again, that you get when you're a kid, that kind of go away when you're an adult. It teaches you how to lose. It teaches you how to not be the best at something and to cope with it like an adult. It teaches you how to work with people that maybe you don't want to work with, or that you don't get along with as well, or that are very different from you, but you have to figure out how to make it work. I just think there's a lot of like things that build your character and your personality that we get from sports, on top of it just being really fun. And for me personally, it gave me a lot of confidence. I tend to be like, yeah, a people pleaser, and I'll overcommit to things and like spread myself thin, but like roller derby is a place where I feel very competent and confident and able to assert my autonomy. And I think that's a thing that draws a lot of individuals into the sport. I think it also helps that the community is very aware of gender, and especially how gendered even the sport of roller derby has been in kind of like the public mind of like women in fishnets and yada yada, where it's really like a lot of leagues are all gender. A lot of folks are trans and non-binary, and like this is the sport for you. Like, this is where you are welcome, I hope, you know. Like, I feel like that's the idea that a lot of leagues are trying to really present, and they don't always do it the best, but I think they're really trying as a sport to be inclusive, and that's something I value. Yeah, it's given me so much, and I miss it.
All right, so now we're going to talk about another life transition for you, which is where we are currently sitting, which is on the porch, patio, however you want to consider it, of your tiny home. So tell us, first of all, if by some reason someone listening to this has not heard of tiny homes at this point in time, what that means and how the hell you ended up living in one.
Oh my God. Okay. Tiny homes. So in sustainability, I think a tiny home is kind of like a bread and butter. It is the idea of living small. It's kind of counter to all of the consumerism that we are conditioned to buy into, the notion that like you need this huge house with like a multiple car garage and like a storage unit for all your extra stuff. In my view, a tiny house is intentionally living counter to that. The tiny house that we're in, I think, is under 200 square feet. It has the tiniest sink in the world. It has a composting toilet, but it does have running water.
And it has a little space heater.
Yes, and a space heater and a fridge. It really has everything that I need. I don't know, similar to like being out in the woods. Like I got divorced and I moved into a tiny house in the woods, and I feel anything but alone. I feel self-contained and empowered and sufficient. And this idea of enoughness, where it's just like, I have what I need. I guess to get to the story of this particular tiny house, I mean, there's a lot there. After I got divorced, I was living in this house. I was essentially cat sitting for a woman in Seattle, cat sitting and house sitting. And I was doing that while I was in school and working. Over the summer, she was originally going to move back into her home for her own reasons, in like September or something. I had gotten accepted into a program in France that was happening in July. She reached out to me in June and was like, hey, I'm actually going to be moving back into my home in July, not September. So I was like, oh my gosh, I need to find a place to live. I need to find a place to live. And also I'm going to France in July, so I need to like figure that out. So I was in the process of like packing my things to leave for this program in France, while simultaneously scrolling Craigslist for places to live. I had always wanted, at least since I moved to Washington and kind of started getting into like the idea of zero waste and minimalism and environmentalism, I knew that I wanted to live in a tiny house or a sailboat.
Or a tiny sailboat.
Or a, well, maybe. I mean, it's not off the table, but I knew that that was something I was interested in, you know, for the last like 6 years. When it came time where it's like, wow, I'm in a position now where I can live wherever I want. I don't have a partner that I have to like convince to move in with me and like give up all their things. Like, this is totally my choice. So I was like, that's what I want to do. And I just happened to stumble upon this ad on Craigslist for the most adorable looking tiny house I've ever seen in my entire life, in a place called Carnation, which I had never heard of in my entire life. I drove out to see it and, you know, like drove this long gravel road, not knowing if I was driving into a scam or not.
Yeah, you did say you found it through Craigslist,
yes,
right?
Yeah. And I was like, well, I hope this is legitimate. And then I got here, and the property owner and his partner were so, so nice. and I was so in love with the place. And after they showed me around, I told them, like, I want this. And they're like, okay, yeah, well, we promised to show it to a few other people, so we'll get back to you.
And you said, no, you don't. No, you won't. Well, it's mine.
I'm a people pleaser, so I said, okay. And then I drove away, and like the whole time I was like, damn, I leave for France tomorrow. I was hoping to lock this in. Oh, well. I was driving home. They were like, we changed our mind. We want to rent it to you. And I was like, oh my God, thank you. Locked it in, literally went to France the next day for a 2-week program in marine ecosystems, which is like another story for another time because it was amazing. I got back from France. I packed my things out of the house that I was house sitting and moved here. And it's been the best place I've ever lived in my entire life. Full stop.
All right, you're going to have to qualify that statement. So what makes it the best place you've ever lived? I mean, granted, you lived in Palmdale, so the bar was set extremely low from the beginning. Sorry, Afro Man.
Yeah.
But you've also lived in Seattle. You've lived in Los Angeles. So what about this place and the little town of Carnation is so great?
Oh my gosh, where do I begin?
You can begin with when we got here to do this interview, there was a deer hanging out 6 inches away from your window, and it didn't run away when you got here.
Yes, I've befriended the deer. I hope I continue to. I mean, that's been the biggest thing. It is, looking at the porch right now, it just looks into the woods. Beautiful trees. I see deer probably daily. There are some mornings where I wake up because they're right outside my window, which is like a complete juxtaposition from like waking up in the night from sirens outside the window, like in LA. I see deer, I hear coyotes at night, I hear owls on most nights. The stars are incredible here. I feel very in tune with nature living in this space that I haven't in other ways, for better or worse. I mean, you know, during the cold snap, like my pipes froze, but at the same time, you know, I was surrounded by like beautiful icicles and I was just kind of like, yeah, this is happening in nature and I am feeling it. When it's really windy, the place shakes. But when it rains, it makes the most beautiful like pitter patter against the roof that I wouldn't trade for the world. I don't have a TV and I don't want one. Like if I have time, I will just like walk out on the porch and like read a book or just like look at the birds or other incredible wildlife that are just here. I don't know. There are just so many things about this space where I feel it's like the forest bathing. I feel like my nervous system has calmed down. I feel happier. I feel connected. I don't feel alone. And also like the space is really gorgeous. The owner of the tiny house, her father and brother built it for her. And I mean, you can see like there are hearts like cut out of all the drawer handles and like just everything was intentionally chosen and built with love. And I feel like I feel that being in it. She brought this tiny house on a trailer, it's still on a trailer, to this spot in Carnation. And she was renting this space from the property owner. And then they fell in love. Is that not the cutest thing ever? So then she moved into his home and they started renting this tiny house. I don't know. It just feels like this is a very like loving, warm, like nurturing space. I think it's reflected in the way that this place is built. I love being able to like wake up in it. It's got a loft bed. That's really cool. I had an older sister and we had bunk beds and I always had to be on the bottom. So I feel like this is finally my chance to be on the top bunk. It's just everything about it. I literally cannot think of a better living situation, especially for me right now. Like it kind of feels like a dream come true. And I.
All right. So after all those lovely things, now I'm going to ask you, a mean question since you were so happy about it. Are there any downsides? Are there anything about living in a tiny home that's rough or harder than living in a big old home?
Laundry is a little hard. I am very lucky in that the property owner has a detached garage, which has a very tiny washer and dryer. And I mean tiny.
You said it was the size of a microwave.
Right? It is literally the size of a microwave. So I have to wash like my fitted sheet separate from my flat sheet because they just don't fit at the same time. They just don't. That is probably like my one and only complaint. And honestly, like that's pretty marginal. Yeah, things take longer here. Similar to what I said earlier about being really in tune with nature and the elements, like when it gets really icy, I can't leave, you know, and that happened a couple times. And it ended up being fine because, you know, I was able to like work remotely. And I know that's like a privilege and a luxury that a lot of people don't have. But it's kind of the same thing with like my laundry, where it's like, well, if I can't finish washing it today, oh well, like that's just kind of the way it is. Not being able to leave during the freeze, oh well. You know, the power going out on occasion, oh well. Like, I don't know. It's just all, it's so far outweighed by all the good things that I have trouble even thinking. I will say Carnation is not known for its cuisine or its coffee. So I guess those could be complaints, but it has nothing to do with the tiny house. And Carnation's great. I love Carnation. Shout out to Carnation. Yeah, I'm hard-pressed to think of anything else negative.
So you're also very close to Snoqualmie. If people don't recognize the name of that place, if they grew up watching Twin Peaks, then they saw the big waterfall and the mountains and everything because parts of that show were shot there. So that's a beautiful, cool place. I don't know, how's the cuisine and the coffee in Snoqualmie? Can you drive just the extra 15 minutes there to get it there?
I mean, it's better than Carnation.
And then, you know, Seattle proper is not far away.
No, it's actually really amazing. I go to school and I work in Bothell, and that's like 35 minutes from here. It's really nothing. And it's about the same distance to Seattle. So I actually really love it that I'm removed enough from the cities and the noise and the pollution, but close enough to it that if I really want like an overpriced latte, I can make that happen.
You can also learn to make those things. You have enough space that you could make them here in the tiny home.
I suppose. I feel like if I had that appliance, I would have to get rid of one of my other appliances is the problem. Someone's like, you should just get a rice cooker. And I'm like, but then I have to get rid of my toaster oven.
So what you're having to do is compromise. You're learning the value of compromise instead of compromise being a negative.
Absolutely. I mean, I worked in fashion and I enjoy clothes, but I haven't bought a single item of clothing since I moved here because I literally cannot fit anything in my closet. So if I have to get something new, I have to get rid of something else. And that's actually been a really great thing for sustainability. In my mind, it's just like an awareness that like, yeah, I don't actually need that thing.
Is it benefiting you financially? Is it cheaper to live in the tiny home? And the fact that you're not buying as many things now because you can't, is that also benefiting you financially?
Yes. I mean, yeah, I think in multiple ways. I mean, it's also changed, I think the biggest way is that it's changed my values a lot. When I lived in Seattle, the fun thing to do or the relaxing thing to do or the thing I would do to treat myself would be to like go for a walk out of my apartment and go walk to a coffee shop and like buy a coffee and like hang out there. Not to say that there's anything bad about that, but that's just not what I do now. Like now if I want a break, I walk out, go walk through the woods or look at the trees, and then I can make a cup of tea here. So I think it's just the difference in having to go somewhere and like spend money on a thing to like, I don't know, relax. It's a very different definition of relaxation here. And I'm grateful for it because it's definitely saved me money. I mean, even cooking, like I'm not the best cook and I'm certainly limited in my small kitchen, but at the same time, it's made me realize that like I get equal sustenance from the things I'm able to cook inside that tiny house. And I feel maybe more proud of myself for managing to cook in the tiny kitchen without having to spend a bunch of money.
So tiny home, probably not a permanent thing in your life. Do you have a sense how long you might want to do the tiny home thing, or are you just going to ride it out and see where it takes you?
You know, I don't see myself going back to a full-sized home. I just don't. Like, not to say that this situation is permanent because I don't, you know, own it. At the same time, like, my parents were avid yard salers and probably, if we're being honest, a bit hoardery. After my dad died and just thinking about all of the stuff that you acquire that you can't take with you has made me realize that I don't want that for myself. So being in this situation, I just feel like if I were to go back to a full-sized home or something like that, I would end up filling space with stuff I don't need. So I don't see myself going back. I don't know if it'll always be a tiny house, but it might be a tiny house and then a sailboat or a tiny sailboat or even like a camper van. I don't know. I think I don't want to go back.
All right. So we're approaching that point. We're going to have to wrap this all up. And I feel like we've talked about a lot of things and covered a lot of important things. So I'm going to take you to the final question, the way I always end the show, which is, what is the final thought you want to leave the audience with?
I have a lot. I guess the biggest thing I want to impress upon people listening is that there is hope in sustainability. There is hope in individual action. And I personally and anecdotally believe that all of that is rooted in your own connection with nature. I think that we have come to believe ourselves as separate from nature. I think that we've come to think of nature as resources that we extract or control or can control even. And I think that that mindset, I think it will become a thing of the past. I think it's a question of when we as a society can actually shift and make that change in mindset. But I think between, you know, looming climate catastrophe and all of the young people that are really caring about their futures and really pushing the conversation and pushing for like these paradigm shifts, I think it'll happen. What I've been telling people about forest bathing is I almost feel like I'm trying to start a revolution in my own right of just changing people's relationship to nature to make them realize their part in saving it.
I think that is a lovely way to wrap all of this up. And I want to thank you for hanging out on your little porch with me and recording this.
Thank you so much. Thank you for making it out.
So you may all be happy to know that Morgan is doing well. She recently graduated with her BAS in Sustainable Practices. She is starting a position at Adaptive Cycling Center at the Outdoors for All Foundation. She is also pursuing that certification as a forest bathing guide, and she is a member of Cascadia Forest Therapy. So she has moved forward with all of the things that we talked about in this episode. And now it's that part of the show where I invite you all to go to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this episode 121 with Morgan McShay. And there you're going to find photographs of Morgan in action and links to all of the things we talked about in today's show. And while you're there perusing the internet, if you would like to get in touch with us here at the show, you can do that a number of ways. You can send me an email, jason@gogetoutside.com. Or leave a voice message or send a text message to 818-925-0106. And please go to your podcast purveyor of choice. Make sure you are subscribed. And if you would, please rate and review the show. And most importantly, share it with someone who you think would enjoy it. And also a reminder to check out our Go Get Outside podcast YouTube page. You can find these episodes there, but also a lot of additional videos that I think you would all enjoy. Next time on the show, come back July 1st for a conversation with Glenn Van Pesky. You may recognize that name as the accidental founder of Gossamer Gear, the preeminent ultralight gear company. And he is also the author of a new book, Take Less, Do More. So come back July 1st for a great conversation with Glenn Van Pesky. See you then.